You can get 10 weeks of The Spectator, as well as unlimited access to our website, app, and archive, if you subscribe today. Go to spectator.co.uk/PIMS to get a free bottle of PIMS and 10 weeks of the issue for just £10. That's spectator.co.uk/PIMS. But hurry, it's only while stocks last.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and Isabel Hardman. On Monday, Boris Johnson suggested that he would lobby Joe Biden to extend the deadline by which US troops plan to leave Afghanistan. Today there's been a G7 meeting. There's also been a press conference from the Taliban, as has become the new normal. And the signs aren't looking particularly positive, are they, Isabel, when it comes to how long troops are going to stay?
No, so it was quite a bold move of Boris Johnson's to brief that he was going to request an extension to this deadline, knowing that it was unlikely to be granted. And we've had a press conference from the Taliban reiterating the warning that it would be a violation to continue evacuations of Americans after the 31st of August deadline. Then we had a line from Pentagon spokesman John Kirby that the deadline wasn't going to change. And the G7 call on which he made this bid has not moved things on. So it's not been a success from that perspective for the Prime Minister. And this was something that Defence Secretary Ben Wallace and his colleagues in the Ministry of Defence have been warning that actually there's only really hours left to get people out of Afghanistan. And once the Americans have gone, that's when everyone else has to go as well. There's not really a question of sort of Britain and France and so on continuing in the country beyond that date.
Fraser, clearly the first and foremost issue is getting people out of Afghanistan. But in terms of that Boris Johnson intervention, do you think the fact that it has had little impact is something which can negatively impact the Prime Minister? Or was the point here to show that the UK would take a different approach to the US if it were able to?
I think the purpose of this was simply to protest, to say that Britain disagrees with the United States and its 31st of August deadline. It's not just Britain, the French have complained about it as well. Everybody else who needs US protection has complained that when Biden set the deadline, they couldn't understand why it was so short. For these protests to be public, I guess it's something. But then again, what's Britain, what's France, what's any other country going to do about it? What is slightly more worrying is that the Taliban seem to be saying now that they will block Afghans trying to leave the country. That foreigners can come to the airport, but Afghans cannot. Now, this means that unless you're an Afghan being transported in a road convoy by Western troops into the airport, you're unlikely to make it past a Taliban checkpoint. That makes it a lot harder to evacuate the sort of people that we need to evacuate. Now, those evacuations have been going at a pretty big pace. I mean, since Kabul fell just Sunday last week, there's been something like 60,000 Americans who've gone, and I think 25,000 in the last day. Britain's evacuated something like 8,500, of which 5,000 are Afghans eligible for relocation. So that's a lot of Afghans to get out of, that Britain's got out of Kabul. That mission will obviously become more dangerous if the Taliban is now saying, no, you're not going to take our, as they put it, our doctors, our engineers, our nurses, they're needed for reconstructing Kabul. Of course, the risk and the suspicion is that what they want to do is simply find and issue punishments against those who did operate and help out Western forces over the last few years. So it's a very difficult moment. And my sense is there's the potential for it to get more difficult still.
What do you mean by more difficult still, Fraser? How do you see it escalating?
Well, there are two ways this can play out. I spoke to somebody senior in government recently who said that, look, this situation could calm itself. We could end up with a normal Kabul with civil flights back, and things might right themselves pretty quickly. So you could have not exactly British Airways going to Kabul, but certainly Pakistan Airways chartered civil flights out to the Gulf. Or there were also reports in the last few hours, and I don't know how seriously to take these, but I'm struck by them, that the Taliban executions, punishment executions, have already begun. The United Nations say they've had credible reports of this happening. Now, if the Taliban are already basically losing patience with even the going through the veneer of cooperating with the West and are starting recriminations or starting executions, we face a potentially very difficult situation next week, as we've only got a week to go until the deadline passes, where the executions could be starting. Women are being told to stay indoors. We're getting reports of that as well. At the same time when the West is retreating. Now, this is a debacle so far, but it's a debacle which is made slightly better by the fact that some people can cling to the fig leaf of a Taliban 2.0, a new, kinder, gentler Taliban, who are more interested in keeping order and impressing their new friends in the international community for legitimacy, not just in Afghanistan, but overseas. But if that quickly gives way to the Taliban regime that we deposed, then it could get politically far worse for America, for the West, to actually be evacuating while these executions are taking place.
Isabel, Fraser mentioned the Taliban 2.0, and we've also, as you mentioned, hearing reports now that despite the Taliban saying women would have a right to education, in some cases could work, the women have been told to stay at home for their own safety. Potentially, once new procedures are put in place, some may be able to return to the workplace. So does this put some of those politicians and leaders in a bind who have said almost, you know, they appear different, we need to take them at their word, the fact that things are changing so quickly on the ground?
Yeah, I think there's a debate over how much time you give the Taliban before you start saying you can't trust a word that they say. And it's striking that a number of people who've actually served in the country, I mean, we talk a lot about Tom Tugendhat on this podcast, but he has consistently said that the one consistent thing about the Taliban is that you can't trust what they say. And there's a question of how much to trust anything that they are saying. So that, as you said, the latest line from them on women's rights and safety is that they should stay at home because they haven't got things set up in terms of their security. They need to make sure that their operatives are treating women properly before they allow them back on the streets again, which sounds all very convenient, doesn't it? And one wonders how long it's going to take for them to talk to their operatives to make sure that they're going to behave in the right way around women. So you can understand why a lot of women who have benefited hugely from the freedoms that they've had over the past 20 years are quite worried at the moment and are not taking the Taliban at their word. There's also a debate around sanctions for the Taliban and who that would actually hurt. Will that hurt the people who are left behind in the country, who the British and American evacuation efforts haven't managed to get to because they're not near Kabul? You know, they're in Helmand province, for instance, and it's very difficult to get to the airport. Or would the sanctions actually hurt the Taliban? Now, it seems at the moment that the British government does want to at least threaten the Taliban with sanctions, given that Dominic Raab has written about that in the Daily Telegraph today. But there has also been a pushback from the Taliban saying that they don't really care about Western aid, about Western funding and so on. And so you can see them taking quite a bullish position on this, potentially to try to extract a bit more in a sort of slightly more traditional negotiating position, or actually just to say, look, you know, you can go on about human rights, women's rights, democracy and so on, but we don't actually care. And the way in which you conduct things is over in this country.
Meanwhile, back in the UK, we've been hearing from Nicola Sturgeon. She's given a press conference where she's talking about how fast case numbers are climbing in Scotland. And Fraser, she talks about how she can't rule out restrictions if they continue to go at this rate.
That's right. This is an interesting moment. So we are seeing several countries in the world now where cases are back on the rise. I'm not sure whether you can call this a fourth wave or a fifth wave. You kind of lose count. But certainly, if you look at Israel, we've got Anshul Pfeiffer is writing a piece for the new magazine, which comes out on Thursday, looking at what's happening there. Now, he's saying that the Israelis are saying, yes, there is a wave, it is going up a lot, but whatever we're going to do, we're not going to lock down. We're going to do anything other than lockdown, because these cases simply do not translate into serious illness in the way that they once did. That they're finding out, for example, that the Pfizer vaccine after 6 months is only 39% effective against infections, But when it comes to actually serious illness and hospitalizations, it remains 80%. In other words, you're going to get a lot of people who have been vaccinated who are going to contract COVID and test positive, but they're not going to get seriously ill. So the Israelis think, look, it's time to stop looking at cases, because the cases now will be misleading as an indicator of how serious things are. Nicola Sturgeon is taking a different view. She's Scotland's recorded its highest ever number of COVID cases. We've got figures up in the Spectator Data Hub showing that. And she is talking about bringing back restrictions. Now, that's quite possible. It's a response to it. Although, as we also show in the Spectator Data Hub, the hospitalizations in Scotland have been nowhere near what they were in the second wave. So what Scotland has just demonstrated to the rest of the UK, because it was ahead of England and the rest of the world, is that a surge in cases need not put pressure on the NHS. So why would you necessarily impose more restrictions? But Nicola Sturgeon, of course, she's also announced her own inquiry into this, which I think is very politically interesting.
Yes, Isabel, Nicola Sturgeon has confirmed a judge-led independent inquiry, which will be established by the end of the year. This puts pressure on Boris Johnson, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's classic Nicola Sturgeon, isn't it? So the UK-wide inquiry into the government's handling of COVID is due to start in spring 2022. And Boris Johnson's argument is that by then, the NHS, the other institutions involved in dealing with the pandemic, won't be under as much pressure and won't be distracted by an inquiry. So Nicola Sturgeon is moving her inquiry a few months forward to put pressure on Boris Johnson to move his inquiry to being more immediate. And you know, there's a lot of emotional pressure coming. You've already got relatives of people who've died of COVID saying, well, look, the Scottish government have done this. So, you know, Boris Johnson, you need to do the decent thing and speed up this inquiry. And it's just in keeping with the way in which the Scottish government, Nicola Sturgeon, have generally handled coronavirus. You talk to anyone who's involved in public health up here and they'll say that, you know, they'll do all the detailed work on the modelling, the figures and so on. And then the Scottish government will say, yes, but what's England doing and how can we do it very slightly differently? It's a little bit like the American dictionary, just the way in which America demonstrated that it was different to British English people just by changing a few letters in various words. And you've got this with the Scottish government's handling of COVID as well.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, Isabel. And thank you for listening.